In Elko?
We have no public comment in Elko.
Thank you. Any public comment in Reno?
There is none in Reno.
Thank you. Any public comment in Las Vegas? Seeing none, is there any written public comment? No, thank you. All right, so we will go on to item number two, minutes of the July 30th, 2021 meeting. Do I have a motion to approve?
So moved.
Thank you, Regent Perkins.
Second.
Second from Regent McMichael. Is there any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Item number three, chair's report. So as a just a quick clarification, since Chair Pro Tem Del Carlo is now the chair, she's not chairing this committee. As the vice chair of this committee, I'll just be taking over the running of this meeting today. And so I don't really have prepared comments so much, but I did want to mention that Chair Del Carlo and I and Regent Byron Brooks attended ACCT in October along with President Solis and some of his leadership team. It was a great conference. I would recommend it to all of my fellow regents. President Solis's team presented on their prison education program. We heard many great things about that. Also, Regent Del Carlo, Chair Pro Tem Del Carlo, has been elected to a three-year term on ACCT's board. And so that's a wonderful honor both for her and for the system, since this is national recognition and national engagement in the community college leadership sphere. So congratulations to Chair Del Carlo for that. And there was much to learn at this conference. So I appreciate the attendance by my fellow regents and the presentation by President Solis. Thank you. All right, on to item number four, Community College Workforce Certificate Productivity. Vice Chancellor Abba.
Thank you. For the record, Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs and Community Colleges. Just a reminder, at the September meeting, this committee heard a report on degree productivity, essentially at the 65,000-foot level. So we were looking at awards conferred by type of award within certain disciplines. And what you saw over a period of time was tremendous growth and accomplishments that the community colleges have made, particularly in recent years, in supporting student success. And from that, this committee, in looking at that data for certificates and skill certificates in particular, those numbers were not as robust as one would have expected given the growth in other areas. And so with that, this committee very diligently requested a follow-up presentation. So think of this as we're drilling down. We started at the 100,000-foot view. Now we're at about the 35,000-foot view. Over the last several months since that request, the community colleges have come together for the purpose of this presentation and had a number of really good conversations. So I think you're in for a treat this morning. It's a good way to start off the day. And so with that, I will turn it over to Vice President Alexander. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, members of the committee. I'm Kyle Dalby, Provost and Senior Vice President at Western Nevada College. We'll get started. We have a number of slides in the deck. We'll go through them at a pretty quick clip. I'll do the first two, then I'll hand it off to my colleagues and come back. What we're going to talk about this morning, as the Vice Chancellor set up for us, is credentials, meeting employer and student demands and how we do that at the campus level, how we receive input from workforce development agencies, in particular one example from EDON, current and national trends data, non-credit and credit pathways, and considerations and next steps. That's the overview of the slides. So quick definitions, just to give everyone a briefer on this. Our skills certificates, which are IPEDs, acknowledged credentials, run 9 credits to 30 credits. So we kind of say anything under 30 credits, but more than 9, and we're looking into that. Those are short-term certificates that students can earn. They're tied with an industry-recognized credential, something that that it can be transported across the country, the world, depending on the industry. When we talk about certificates of achievement, we're talking about 30 credits or more, generally in the 30 to 40. We don't want to go more than that because the next step is associate degrees at 60 credits or more. And then some of us do have BAS degrees, which stack onto that, which would be 120 degrees. We're not going to go into that today, but that's the sequences of skill certificates. One steps into another. Skills, less than 30. Certificate of achievement, 30. Associate degree, 60 plus.
Good morning, committee. James McCoy, Vice President for Academic Affairs at the College of Southern Nevada, for the record. It's a pleasure to be here this morning as we talk about some of the dialogue picking up from the last quarterly meeting of this committee, as Vice Chancellor Abba had noted. So each of us will spend just a couple of minutes talking about some of the nuances of our data surrounding each of these credentials of value at our institutions. And perhaps even more importantly, talk about where we're headed in our strategic planning to amplify each of these areas. So this first slide that you're seeing on behalf of CSN is a snapshot slide that you saw, I believe, in the last meeting, sort of showcasing the number of skill certificates. As Kyle mentioned, these are those certificates that are under 30 credits, oftentimes, not often, all the time, with embedded industry-recognized credentials, and or leading a student to sit for an exam. And so you can see at CSN, we've got just nearly 1,600 or so skill certificate completers and 1,534 in the previous years. Following that, you see the categorization of certificate of achievements, and you see a much lower number there, and I'm going to explain why that is in just a moment, and then you move into our associate degrees and then our bachelor's degrees. In thinking about the path forward at CSN to get more students in and through these credentials of value, we sort of categorize where we're looking at this in three different ways. The first is the academic master planning framework. Now, just yesterday, I believe the full board and through the ARSA committee heard about the academic master plan additions that each of our institutions are considering. And that is a really iterative process and an important process, particularly as we're looking at the credentials of value that lead one to the workforce. And in this context, at CSN, we're building out the stackable credential approach, certainly an approach that's nationally recognized and an approach that all of our institutions within the INSHE system are engaged in. In the context of a community college, and more specifically at CSN, the stackable credential approach centers around the student earning a skill certificate in a given pathway. They continue in that given pathway, and that stackable credential, that skill certificate, stacks into the next level of credential, in this case, a certificate of achievement. And then those credits and that learning stacks into the next level of achievement, of course, an associate's degree. And if we do it right, and as applicable by pathway, all of this learning, all of these learning outcomes then stack in to a bachelor's degree and beyond. So we're looking in these industry sectors for every opportunity we can to have these milestone credentials earned, sort of like many finish lines along the way. And I'm going to give you a visual example of what that looks like in just a moment. So the academic master planning framework is one in which we're engaged in currently, and it is an annual experience. Next is a dramatic focus on the skill certificates that are under 9 credits. So right now, our skill certificates are defined as credentials of value, industry-recognized curriculum, where when a student walks out with this skill certificate in hand, they should be employable in their given guided pathway. What we need to do a better job of at CSN, and as a system, I believe, is recognizing that our business and industry partners ought to be telling us what the curriculum needs to be, and more specifically, what the learning outcomes need to be, and even more specifically, what the national or state recognized credentials are that business and industry recognize that ought to be implanted within our curriculum. And sometimes that's, curricularly speaking, from a seat time standpoint, 9 credits. Sometimes it's 12, sometimes it's 18, sometimes it's 20. But sometimes it's under 9, Sometimes it's just 6 credits. Take CNA, for example. Certainly a valuable skill certificate, the certified nursing assistant. But from a seat time standpoint, may not necessitate something over 9 credits. So we're talking about these conversations in the Academic Affairs Council as led by Vice Chancellor Abba. And finally, our intentional dual credit pathways. One of the charges that Dr. Zaragoza gave to us when he arrived at CSN was to double down our efforts in the context of early college programming for students, particularly as it relates to workforce development. And so as we build out these skills certificates and these certificates of achievement and these stackable credentials along the way, we're doing so with intentionality around career and technical education pathways within the context of dual credit or concurrent enrollment or CTE college credit, and ensuring that as students complete their high school experience in our early college programs, more and more of them will have the opportunity to actually earn a credential of value, perhaps that first level skill certificate. This is my favorite slide, and this is an example, a visual example of the skill certificate, pardon me, the stackable credential approach I was just alluding to. This is a snapshot of what we're doing in the area of advanced manufacturing. As a matter of fact, the ARSA committee will soon hear all of our plans in preparation for the March quarterly meeting around this industry sector of advanced manufacturing. And so as you look at the left-hand side of the screen, the student entry point, these are students who are entering into our Division of Workforce and Economic Development or entering into an advanced manufacturing pathway within the within the secondary education space through a dual enrollment platform. But essentially, these starting points, these basic skills in skills training for the most basic level of employee are happening at the front door. But then you see that overlap into two different bifurcated pathways on the top and on the bottom. And each of these bifurcated pathways are within the context of advanced manufacturing. The top is the machining pathway, the bottom is the automation pathway. And each of those blue bubbles represent the credential that the student would earn along their pathway. But the beautiful part about these stackable credential approach, of course, is that there's off-ramps. And these off-ramps lead to the employers at every threshold, at every milestone that the student completes. So that first bubble, as students are getting those basic skills, when they walk out of that curriculum, they're employable. They're ready for entry-level advanced manufacturing employment. But we know that's not the finish line for them, because there's opportunity for growth, for forward progression socioeconomically for them and their families. And so they on-ramp back to CSN while they are employed still and continue on their pathway with the next stackable credential opportunity, in this case, the skill certificate. Then they're off-ramping back to the employer with advanced, more advanced level skills. They get their raise, but they're not done yet. They come back and on-ramp to CSN and continue their pathway, but nothing they have done educationally is in vain. Everything stacks into the next level of progression of understanding within the context of advanced manufacturing, either in machining or in automation. And you see that constant ebb and flow. I equate it to a freeway system with on-ramps and off-ramps. All the while, the accumulation of credits within the given pathway are sustained, are built upon one another. And perhaps the beautiful thing, the workforce, the business and industry, the employers are telling us what the curriculum needs to be in these courses, and what the industry-recognized credentials need to be. I'm going to end my piece of this on behalf of CSN talking briefly about the non-credit-to-credit integrated model. And there's 5 big subtle areas here. First is an unbundling of the curriculum. When we talk about the non-credit-to-credit integrated model, as Dr. Zaragoza has pointed out numerous times, at CSN we have nearly 15,000 students pursuing workforce training, adult basic education, in a non-credit space. A lot of times our students are experiencing GED preparation or ESL experiences. But a lot of times they're also engaged in workforce development opportunities and they're building their basic skill sets within a given workforce industry. When we say we're unbundling the curriculum, we're looking at our credit-based courses. And we identify the student learning outcomes within each of our courses within a given industry pathway. And we extract the learning outcomes that need to be taken, unbundle it so it's still credit-based. Maybe as you look at a 3-credit automation advanced manufacturing basic skills course, and we say for this 1 credit, these are the learning outcomes that students need to engage in. And these happen to be the 1 credits of learning outcomes that business and industry are looking for in the context of entry-level employment. We pair our instructors both on the credit and the non-credit side, and that leads us to the IBEST model, number 2. And as you all are aware, the IBEST model that came out of Washington, in fact, the Community College Technical System in Washington, has been researched for over a decade, pairs a basic skills instructor with a technical instructor, and they develop the course together. They bring in workforce industry into the conversation, and then they teach the course together. And so students who perhaps would have never thought they were college ready or college material are all of a sudden getting college level curriculum while engaged in basic adult education, while also making sure it mirrors what business and industry are looking at. At CSN, we have an IBEST model right now. It's getting off the ground, and in our first area of study of this is in HVAC, and it's going wonderfully at our Western High Tech Center. We talked a lot about stackable credentials. Our academic deans and our department chairs and lead faculty across the pathways are working on, in fact, have completed an audit on where all of our gaps are. Where do we not have skill certificates and certificates of achievement that would lend themselves to these milestone credentials? And I think that when I mentioned our data at the front end, where we have these sort of fewer certificates of achievement, it's because we didn't have as much intentionality in the stackable credential approach. So as applicable for every opportunity we have for a skills or a COA that would lend itself to leading to associates, we're going to go after it. We've talked a little bit over the years about the ability to benefit model for GED-seeking students. This is a dual enrollment model, sort of parallel, where students who are seeking, adult learners who are seeking a GED, when we provide to them the opportunity in an integrated way to take 6 college credits to prove they are college ready while they're engaged in their GED, just like a dual enrollment student, traditional dual enrollment student would experience. At the completion of that 6 credits, once they've shown that they have proven their ability to benefit, that triggers something pretty amazing. That triggers federal financial aid eligibility while they're still pursuing their GED. There's a lot of nuances to that, and we're working through that now, but that's part of our game plan. And then finally, our alignment to Nevada industry sector growth areas. As we all know, there are very specific industry sectors within our state that we're all working so diligently hard to ensure we've got academic and career-ready pathways in these areas. Advanced manufacturing, IT, cybersecurity, healthcare, skilled trades, can continue. As we partner with economic development agencies and workforce development agencies, our chambers of commerce, our business and industry partners in these pathways, I just want to reiterate again the importance that as institutions of higher learning, particularly in the workforce space, that not only are our ears open to what business and industry needs are, but they're at the table telling us. And perhaps even more importantly, they're helping us to deliver this education by becoming our part-time instructors, by engaging in internship and externship opportunities, and no doubt, as we've seen over and over again, financially at the table as well through their philanthropic support of our institutions. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Jake, at GBC.
Vice President McCoy, I think we have a question for you real quick, if you don't mind.
Sure. Thank you. The question I have is, are all those programs run on a semester basis, fall semester, spring semester, then summer?
Yeah, it's dependent upon the pathway itself. But to your point, this is the national best practice, which you're alluding to. The ability to on-ramp at any time in the semester or any time of the year, not wait for our traditional 16-week terms. Oh, I missed it, got to wait 6 months.
That's my point. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. So that lens in this work is absolutely important.
Great.
Thank you for acknowledging that.
Good morning, committee. For the record, my name is Jake Rivera, Vice President for Student and Academic Affairs at Great Basin College. So taking a look again at the graph on GBC awards by type that was previously presented to you by Vice Chancellor Abba, GBC saw a tiny bump of about 1.2% increase in skill certificates between 2014-15 and 2019-20, a 273% increase in our certificates of achievement over 10 years, a 38% increase in associate degrees over 10 years, and a 110% increase in bachelor degrees over a 10-year span. Today, though, I want to shed some additional light on GBC certificates. So GBC offers 15 skill certificates and another 18 certificates of achievement in areas of business, computer technology, education, health sciences, CTE, and we are the only NC institution offering a transferable general certificate of achievement for dual enrollment students across the state. At GBC, we see these certificates as stackable credentials that can be accumulated over time to build up a student's qualifications and help them move along on a career pathway. Our faculty and advisors promote them as building blocks where each short-term credential that a student earns builds into a higher level credential, as you just heard from my CSN colleague, Dr. McCoy. So, how do we award skill certificates at Great Basin College? The GBC Institutional Research Office runs regular reports each semester that identify students who have completed course requirements and are eligible for a skill certificate. The report is sent to the registrar's office for a degree audit check, and the registrar's office designates the students as having met certificate requirements. Every opportunity to communicate these milestones or building blocks contributes to keeping students on track to further their educational pursuits. But what's important to note is that not all credentials are tracked through this institutional reporting process or the NC Awards data that you saw. For example, let's say you have an industrial maintenance student who took courses with GBC related to basic hydraulic systems. The student then goes on to do a credentialing test with NIMS, that's the National Institute for Metalworking Skills, and they pass. But a student passing a NIMS credentialing test is not necessarily reported out, and therefore not included in the numbers that were identified on that first slide. Are we responding to rural Nevada workforce needs? Yes, GBC has responded to local industry needs. We do this directly with our industry partners, through our advisory councils, and with organizations such as the Northeastern Nevada Development Authority. More recently, industry has asked for programs that address new technologies surrounding the autonomous equipment operations. We are not only looking at this in the short term with existing pathways for students in diesel, electrical, welding, and millwright, but how these might fit within a broader program such as the new BAS degree in engineering technology that we hope to move forward with in the next fall. So a closer look at the data. With the 1.2% increase in those skill certificates, we wanted to take a deeper dive into why only 1.2%. What you can't see from the chart is that as CT enrollments increase or decrease, so do our skill certificates. While GBC was up in overall enrollment in 2019-20, we were down in the CTE areas. This was in large part due to unfilled faculty positions in diesel and millwright, as well as CNA and EMT, that, as you know, have been difficult to fill when you're competing with industry pay. So what are some of the challenges faced by community colleges looking into increasing their certificate enrollments? It's a fact. There are over 26,000 educational programs in the United States that offer certificates. Due to much of it being driven by the states, it's difficult to establish a more comprehensive system of stackable credentials to extend portability for learners and workers within and across states. But before we can even establish a comprehensive system, we also have to ensure that these stackable credentials come with a clearly defined system of competencies linked to employment opportunities and advancement in career. So one of the first challenges, labor market driven programs requires being ready to respond. At the request of industry, GBC adopted the Cisco networking program. GBC was able to quickly add the Cisco skills certificates to our offerings. Cisco was added as another option to our networking pathways and consequently is now the only networking pathway offered. Initially, the program saw good enrollment numbers, but local industry demands dwindled, illustrating the need to be flexible. Through increased measures on our internal program review, we are asking ourselves, are the certificates we are offering competitive and meeting current industry needs? Challenge number two, transferability of certificate programs to four-year institutions can be a barrier for students who want to move forward but not start all over. Skill certificates are usually not designed for transfer to four-year institutions, and that's unfortunate because many students are asking, how is this portable? How can I expand on my educational training at a later time? I'll talk about one promising strategy being used in Utah on the last slide. The third challenge, industries are creating their own training programs. If institutions are not reacting quickly, industry will continue to create their own training programs. Industry giants like Google and Microsoft, they're not going to wait around. They're supplanting with training that is short, flexible, and connected to get around barriers imposed by institutions that are requiring lengthy application processes, various pricing structures, and full semester courses. Challenge number four, looking at these certificates with an equity lens. Very important to Great Basin College, and a personal concern of mine, is to not overlook the impact that short-term vocational programs have on our underserved populations. Many of our underserved populations will make up a large fraction of tomorrow's workers, and at GBC, we are being very intentional in our advisement practices and how to promote skill certificates without moving away from GBC students developing those soft skills. The future of the workplace is going to get more complicated and challenging, and we need students that are prepared with the interpersonal, critical thinking, and analytical reasoning to go on to be leaders if they so choose. Last challenge, the financial aid challenge. So often it is our students seeking a skill certificate who are likely to have the highest unmet need. Yet, students enrolled in a skill certificate program may not be eligible for financial aid unless the courses taken are part of the associate's or bachelor's degree requirements. This has been a challenge for institutions and so many thanks to the work that's already been done with the Sandy Grant. We see some promise here. So GBC has already taken advantage of the Sandy Grant with our CNA programs, and that's benefiting more students who want to enroll that were not eligible for financial aid. All right, so where do we go from here? We see more opportunities with dual enrollment. GBC offers a construction HVAC program anchored at Elko High School. This program provides a pathway to employment or to one of GBC's CTE programs. Students earn an NCCER credentials that are counted for credit in the diesel technology or industrial millwright program. At White Pine High School, students can enroll in our diesel technology program, and at Pahrump Valley High School, we're offering manufacturing machining technology. GBC is looking at further investigating skill certificates in cybersecurity, blockchain, accounting, and bookkeeping. Expansion of our certified nursing assistant programs are also underway at Nye County and Humboldt School Districts. We're reviewing our curriculum to ensure every associate and bachelor degree utilizing any industry recognized credentials that might be available to our students. If we're offering continuing education programs that offer credentials in such areas as project management, supply chain, data analytics. We want to regularly communicate about these alternative avenues to give that business student an edge. We're looking at best practices at BYU's Pathway Program, where the university and the community college are working together. At BYU and Provo, Utah, students are required to earn short-term certificates en route to an associate or bachelor degree, which means students who stop out are still able to show an employer or completed certificate. Finally, we're working with our communications team to promote our skill certificates through targeted marketing. We're already doing this with the advantages of the Sandy Grant that I was talking about in key areas across rural Nevada. Communication with our industry partners is critical to the success of our certificate programs, And at GBC, we hope to expand the conversations through establishing a rural workforce conference that would focus on industry training priorities. Thank you, and I'll turn it over to my colleague at TMCC, Dr. Jeff Alexander.
Good morning, members of the Community College Committee. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. I'm Jeffrey Alexander, Vice President of Academic Affairs at Truckee Meadows Community College, for the record. I'd like to certainly honor and underline what my colleagues have said today thus far, and I won't reiterate in great detail many of the patterns and processes that they've already described, which are certainly germane to the kinds of skills certificates we offer at TMCC as well. I'd like to point to this chart here and underline for a moment that it illustrates a tremendous accomplishment in the arena of skills certificate offerings and completions, which number typically around 74 or 75 in a given year, and about half as many, around 40, 38 to 40 certificates of achievement. Bar graphs are illustrative and helpful. Sometimes, however, they appear to illustrate disparity where none exists. What I mean by that is, though the bars here in the certificate of achievement realm are smaller, this is by no means a difficulty. Very often, students are completing skill certificates on purpose, by choice, and this is very much because we are listening to industry, and what the industry partners are telling us is that they very much want shorter certificates. They want the kinds of skills that students can earn quickly, get in, get out, get back to work, and bring those skills to the workforce. And so I'll sort of focus on those themes a little more closely here. As we can see, there is this laddered approach, as my colleagues mentioned. We can see that there are those who earn one or more skill certificates only. There are those who do carry on and perhaps start with a certificate of achievement only. And there are those who earn both types of certificates, but it is a much smaller number, much, much smaller. Very few actually carry on to a certificate of achievement in that regard. However, those who earn a skill certificate and then return to earn an associate degree are a much larger number. And again, there are some who earn a certificate of achievement, that larger certificate, and then pursue an associate degree. The laddering effect is clear, but what's more clear and what's more important is that in this regard, we are responding to the needs of industry, and our workforce partners are telling us that shorter certificates are key. And this is why the largest share of the pie, basically a third, is in the skills arena, in the skills certificate arena. When I wrote to Vice President Nancy McCormick at EDON, the Economic Development Authority of Western Nevada, this is what she told me. Generally speaking, we hear from primary employers that as long as the training needs meet industry, the training meets industry needs and matches industry recognized standards, the shorter certificate programs more closely match the needs of the community, which has many open positions not requiring an associate degree. A combination of foundational learning and on-the-job experience is the preference, so that is why internships and apprenticeships are so highly valued. More time in the classroom doesn't necessarily close the skills gap without some form of work experience, work-based learning, or soft skills development. Given the slogan of get in, get out, get a job, and with a demand for workers in the area and the high cost of living, seekers don't have the luxury of just going to school, so getting enough education to get them going quickly on a career path is important, with the opportunity to stack onto their initial education once they have employment and even perhaps tuition aid. Per MC, 12,000 out of 23,000 current jobs posted in the MSA do not require any education at all on the job posting. So a quick certificate or credential is a plus to get them on their way and stand out from other candidates without having spent too much time and money. These are the words of EDON, and these are the words that they are hearing from the many employers with whom they work, and especially from those whom they are trying to encourage to move to Nevada, to set up in Northern Nevada especially, and respond to the kinds of industry needs that they have on hand. Additionally, this is happening nationally. In the Community College Daily, October 23 of this year, the headline was, Americans prefer short-term learning. This is the student voting with their feet and indeed with their dollars. They are coming in to tell us that they want shorter-term certificates. They'd like to earn those skills very quickly. Very often, some of them will tell us in survey data that the credential itself, it does not matter as much to them as the skills. The skills are what matter. And so the data that this publication produced demonstrates that relevance and streamlined programs are the most important aspects for any offering. Stackability is important for some, 10%, and value, of course, 24% here. But in their responses, relevance is key. And so when asked whether I prefer that particular option, the largest number of respondents said it was driven specifically by relevance. They're most interested in an education that meets their needs for the work they have to do. The second, of course, being a streamlined program, they can get in quickly, get out quickly, get back to work. Very often, as their employer sometimes is providing for that time and space for them to complete that apprenticeship or skill certificate, they expect them to return in good time and to apply those skills that they have learned very quickly at the workplace. And with that, I will turn it over once again to Provost Dalby.
Thank you, sir. Thank you again, Kyle Dalby, Provost, Western Nevada College. Both members of my fan club online have informed me that the mic's a little hot, so I'm going to step back a little bit. I won't repeat a lot of what's been said because it all applies to all of the schools, but when you look at our graph on skill certificates, we have a jump there, and I've been asked what was the secret sauce that created the jump in skill certificate back in 2020. The good news for my three colleagues behind me is I have brought three packets of that secret sauce, and I'm going to share it with them. And hopefully that helps. In all seriousness, though, we did something that all of them have done at one point in time. We have listened to our industry employers, like they mentioned, and we have implemented something that leapfrogged our numbers like it is here on this graphic for the skill certificate. And we've all done it. We will continue to do it. That's the response piece that you've been hearing from the other colleges. We will listen to our employers and listen to our students and find out what the marketplace needs. One of the things that is very disruptive to all of us in higher education is when we hear employers say they need skills, they need training, they need to show up at work on time, they need to pass the drug test. A lot of those things we can handle, but they're not saying they need an associate degree, a bachelor's degree, or any type of credential. They're saying they need the training. On our side, we need to say we're doing the training. So we have outlined our traditional credentials, and we capture that. That blends into our completion numbers, our performance pool, and at the end of the day, students really do need a certificate that's portable, certificate or degree that they can take across the country or wherever they go so that they can validate that they have the skills. So our jump in the final year there, the 1920, the blue bar that jumped up, I'm going to explain how that happened. It's kind of a culmination of what was said by my three colleagues as they went through their slides. When I started in fall of 2019, I visited with one of our partners on the outside, an apprenticeship partner. They were looking for an associate degree. They said, we want our apprenticeship students to have an associate degree. That they were adamant about it. We want them to have that credential from the community college. We gave them that. But the experience is that apprenticeship students, when they go through the program, they're not going to do an associate degree. They're going to go out and work, and they're going to make a lot more than probably some of us in this room in the current environment. So we built the pathway, which is the third bullet there, the skills, the certificate of achievement, the associate degree. We gave the employer what they were looking for. We gave the students the pathway in. When we look at those, three steps, the 11 credits in the skills certificate is 32 credits of the certificate of achievement, which is 32 credits of the 60-credit degree. That's the stackable piece. Students are not doing a total of all those credits. They're stepping themselves into it. So our jump was because in spring of 20, when we started awarding the skills certificate, there were a number of students in the pipeline who had not received that, and we pushed that out. Now they are credentialed in the workforce, working, and ready to go. We expect that number to level out. The next new thing will probably make it jump again as we go forward. I think I skipped that one, but that's good. What we find, though, on our certificates of achievement, if you go to our graphic, we're really low on our certificate of achievement. The reason for that is most students who do a skill certificate go off and work. They move into our certificate of achievement sometimes, and sometimes they just do the remaining gen ed and jump straight to an associate degree program, which is what we found. So we're going to try to work on that middle credential a little bit because our numbers are kind of low there. I showed you that example. Another quick example, and then we'll wrap this up. Manufacturing technician, a different program, but you can see it's 4-3-3. So we've got 10 units there that students take. That's a skills certificate example. That'll stack into another level at the applied industrial technology. Same thing with automotive, ASC, the national certification. They can do multiple steps, 10 units, 10 units, 10 units, 11 units. You can see how they all stack, so that becomes a skills certificate that then can stack into a certificate or an associate degree. So with that, to wrap this up, and then I think we can open for questions, comments, we are constantly looking at the value of the credential. We're talking a lot now about non-credit and credit pathways. Most of what was presented was the credit pathways, but what I said earlier about employers, they're not really looking at the transcripts. They're looking at the validated skill for a certain level of workers. We've continued to work with our partners about the pathways and try to make sure that we are navigating that in a way that benefits everybody, in particular the student. We'll develop and scale up the stackable options, and then we will have to push out the information, make it marketable to students, make it something they're looking for, and they're saying, okay, I get it. There's a lot of words out there. We say stackable credentials. If I ask the students over here, they'd probably be like, we don't know what stackable is. But if I asked them what a badge was, I bet you they know what a badge is, or maybe I'm even missing the new and latest term. So there's they understand short-term credentialing in a number of different terms. And we'll just keep doing that and being able to sell that and move forward. So with that, I'll, I guess, open it up for questions, comments from the Vice Chancellor. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that presentation. I really enjoy seeing the collaboration among the four community colleges. I think that's really important. And again, a testament to our system. Yeah, that's right. Regent Perkins, did you have a question?
Actually, that's exactly what I was going to say, Vice Chair Carroll. But I do have I have questions and comments. But yes, it's great to see the collaboration. There's so much. There's great minds right here, so we need to, emphasize that and keep it as a system and make sure that we're all cooperating together. I appreciate that. Actually, in one of the slides, I had wrote down skills, COA to AAS. So that was mind melt, I guess. I was thinking that because those skill certificates are not eligible for financial aid, is there a way that we can make sure that they are? Because I can't, GBC, I think, brought it up that if you're doing a skill certificate, the people that need the skill certificates the most can apply for financial aid because those skill certificates aren't covered. Is there anything that we can do to make sure that can happen?
So Kyle Dalby, Western Nevada College. On the financial aid piece, how to make that happen, I might defer to one of my colleagues. But a skill certificate student can be awarded on the way to an associate degree. So most students will actually declare an associate degree, which would count for financial aid. So that's one option that they can get financial aid on the way, and then we try to keep them going because they sometimes opt out. The other thing is that we've been very fortunate to get scholarship money at I think all the schools, at least the northern schools, that we can say we have financial aid funds for any student who wants to go into a workforce development program.
Thank you for that. Any?
Yeah, it's Jake Rivera for the record. It's just those, if a student wants to pursue just the skills certificate itself, they're not financial aid eligible. And so, that's something to look at in the future. And I know we want to have further conversations about is that the direction. But currently, we do have opportunities, these scholarship opportunities, such as the Sandy Grant. We've been very involved with that process right now, and getting as many of our skill certificate students to go through the Sandy Grant that are eligible. And so I do see some top opportunity there, but expanding the financial aid for skill certificates would also be a tremendous help for our students.
I'll start talking to our federal delegation about that. and also, I was touting weekend, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, pardon me. Thank you, Regent Perkins. For the record, Jeffrey Alexander, TMCC. I would like to add just one update to Kyle's comment about students who can seek an associate degree on the way to a skills certificate and thereby be eligible for financial aid. The challenge with that is, and I'll use the analogy of a previous institution in a different state where I was prior, is that if we ask our registrar how many students who are presently registered in an associate degree program are really just here to pursue a skills certificate and are doing this in order to earn financial aid, the registrar tends to demur and not answer that question. And so the other challenge that this poses, and I think all of us should be aware, is that this means a great many students who are really here to pursue a skills certificate are enrolled in an associate degree program and don't finish. They don't finish the associate degree program. That impacts our completion rate, and therefore it looks as though many students wash out of the associate degree program when they were once declared in it in order to receive financial aid. And so that pattern, sadly, impacts our completion rate, and it appears as though our completers of associate degree programs are somehow not reaching the goal.
So we need to kind of fix that financial aid portion so they can just sign up for the skills degree.
Precisely.
Excellent. Thank you. Last time I was touting the weekend college, and when I went through, that was exactly what I found, is one class was very, very popular, the social media piece. I mean, I had like 5, 7, 10 people want to take that class, but then when they got to the end, it wasn't eligible for financial aid, so they ended up not taking the class, and we lost those students. And so that's my logic and theory behind all of this, is that we need to make sure that we're meeting the students where they are with what they need. And I appreciate community colleges being sometimes the gateway to a better career, better opportunities.
President Zaragoza.
Yeah, if I could, Federico Zaragoza, for the record. Just wanted to address some of the issues on the financial aid side of the house, because I think there's a lot of discussion at the national level. You've heard about short-term Pell, and that is one of the opportunities that you've got here as some of these kind of conversations are migrating to the workforce area. So that's very much a possibility. Then there are a lot of resources in the WIOA system already. They're called ITAs, where they actually sponsor individuals to come to the community colleges for just a short-term outcome. But you have to be an eligible training provider, and there's just a lot of nuances related to that. But one of the national conversations here is, should community colleges be presumptive providers within that space? The other kind of element here that I think is kind of real critical is also the kind of the cost of the infrastructure, if you're going to accelerate programs, et cetera. We're still looking at a scenario where most of the non-credit programs here do not get state support. And so when we're looking kind of at an environment, employers sometimes are better off doing their own internal training because they're covering most of the cost if it's not part of a pathway program, as discussed here. So this whole area is one that I'm so glad that we're having these conversations, because what I hear from employers is that we have to take it to scale. We have a lot of very amazing programs, but the need, if you look at the gaps, the needs are just so huge. And I think that's where you pick up some of that frustration, you know, of why do we have these kind of humongous gaps? It's a lot of moving parts, but this is the conversation, I think, that's going to be very helpful to move the dialogue forward.
Thank you. And if I may want to, somebody brought up start and stop, like, what do you call it? It's not like a semester system. You can just start it, like, every 6 weeks there's classes. Are there more of those? How many of those are there? And I always tout that, you know, community colleges are flexible and they're nimble. And if we only have semesters that start, you know, with agricultural, you know, it's fall and spring, then we're losing a lot of students there also.
Correct, and I'll jump in on that, Kyle. Delpy, Western Nevada College, and then I think it was mentioned by one of my colleagues. We offer a number of open entry classes. The technical piece behind that is they need to all end at the end of the semester in order to be counted, but they can start almost any time during the semester. So students can come in and they can take a class and do the content on their own pace. We've launched that traditionally in the CTE areas, but we've expanded it to some of the other areas, in particular Gen Ed, so we can get some of the students to fill in the blanks. So usually we say if you haven't started by mid-November, you're not going to finish it by the end of the semester. It offers the flexibility. Part of that is been accelerated, of course, by the learning we had to do with the pandemic because it was so much start and stop, but that's actually helping us.
Thank you. That's very encouraging.
Richard Perkins, James McCoy for the record, CSN VPAA. Similarly, and a good example of that, I'll use the automotive technology areas at CSN. The students can come in at the start of the semester, the traditional fall semester. 5 weeks later, we start another cohort. 5 weeks later, another cohort. So there's essentially three in that 16-week window. And then as Kyle mentioned, these mini-mesters experiences from a general education standpoint, sort of the four-week, you get four of those in 16 weeks, so you have four entry opportunities for students to take English, for students to take math, and all those associated general education courses that may be part of a certificate of achievement, for example.
That's awesome.
Thank you. Chair Del Carlo, did you have something?
I do. This was really a great presentation, and your questions are all spot on, Laura, Regent Perkins. And I want to remind this committee that the ACCT National Legislative Summit is coming up in February. Our deadline to get the early bird special is December 15th, and it's going to meet the 6th through the 9th of February. And I would recommend anybody that wants to go on this committee, especially if you're on the community college committee, any regent can go, of course, and I will approve it. And but on the 6th, you can take an extra seminar. It's a couple hours, and it's really worth it, and it gets you up to speed on what the national issues are. The purpose of ACCT, the number one purpose, is advocacy, and they do a fabulous job. It's a coalition of 1,200 community colleges all throughout the United States with, a board, which I'm now on the board. So, I mean, this is our voice, and we all have lobbyists, and I hope we can have a coordinated effort going into that meeting. And this is who they listen to when they're making their legislation. So all good points.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay. We'll move on to the next item. Thank you. Thank you, all of you. Item number 5, Interim Study Committee. Chancellor Rose.
Thank you, Chair Carvalho and members of the Community College Committee. For the record, Melody Rose, Chancellor of the Nevada System of Higher Education. I can be quick on this item because I believe that you all have received an update from me very recently. The governor has officially appointed the members of the AB 450 committee. I shared that out some time ago, and it has also been publicly released at this point. Vice Chancellor Cage and I will also be speaking to this item, the formation of this committee, in our presentation to the full board later today on strategic planning. So we'll have more to say there. However, I did want to simply acknowledge, particularly following on the fantastic presentation by our chief academic officers of the community colleges, that the AB 450 committee is truly a tremendous opportunity for us to revisit some of these needs and barriers that our community colleges have expressed this morning. And very specifically, when the governor announced that he was going to pursue this committee, I had the opportunity to share with him our frustration that our short-term offerings, which is where our economy has such great need, are largely not included in our state appropriation. And so I expect that that issue will come forward through the committee for further examination. And I would hope a recommendation coming out of the committee to repair that gap. And on the federal front, of course, the AB 450 committee doesn't report to Congress. However, I think it is, again, another opportunity for us to look at some of the national legislative conversations that President Zaragoza suggested are imperative for our community colleges here and across the country. Last comment I'll make on this until Vice Chancellor Cage and I come back to it this afternoon is simply that our federal lobbyists are well aware of our advocacy for short-term Pell. We have been very assertive, Vice Chancellor Brooks and I, in educating them about our needs at the federal level. And next week, when she and I are in Washington, D.C., meeting with our delegation, we will remind them of this imperative. So more to come this afternoon, but happy to take questions if there are any.
Regent Perkins?
Thank you for that. Are there students involved in that? I know it's just a committee, but are there like inputs from other stakeholders that are be going into that committee?
Thank you, Chair Carvalho. Carvalho, to you and through you to Regent Perkins, Chancellor Rose here. The composition of that committee is expressed in statute and not within our authority to establish. And so those positions have been appointed by the governor's office. However, those will be public meetings, and we hope and expect that students affected by the work of the committee will be present. And certainly as the co-chair of the committee, I might have some influence to make sure that there is an opportunity to hear from our students. So thank you for the question, and
happy to
talk about it further.
Right, that's really, really important. If we're going to be serving students, we need to know what they need.
Chair Del Carlo.
Thank you. And to your point, the chancellor and I met with students after our meeting ended here. We had about it was over an hour. They just wanted to talk. And we did talk about that because student involvement, I mean, that's why we're here. Let's hear what they have to say. I mean, they don't always get a vote. And, you know, we talked about, I know there's other community colleges that have student representation and a vote, but because of the way we're structured with our constitution, it doesn't define students in that. So, I mean, we can't do that. But they have a seat at these tables, and I think their voices are well heard and well respected by all of us, and we incorporate what they say. So it's a great point, because that's why we're here. We're here for the students. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, moving on to item number 6, Bylaw Revision Community College Committee Charge. Vice Chancellor Abba.
Thank you. For the record, Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs and Community Colleges. I bring to you today an action item that revises the handbook provisions concerning standing committees and their duties, specifically revising the charge of this committee. Before you is a briefing paper and a policy proposal. This is a code change, however, it does not require two hearings, given recent changes in board policy. You'll notice that the briefing paper itself is really long, and there's a reason for that. I think it's one of the longer briefing papers that's ever been presented, and it's because there's a lot of history here that I think is important in the context of considering this proposal. In 2014, going into coming out of the 13 session, actually, there was legislation that had been contemplated in terms of pulling the community colleges out of the system. And from that, they enacted Senate Bill 391 that created the legislative committee to conduct an interim study concerning community colleges. And from that 18-month dialogue with the legislature, a number of changes were made by this board, including the creation of the Vice Chancellor for Community Colleges, who, of course, was the original position was my predecessor. And it created the chancellor at that time recommended the creation of this committee, the Community College Committee. In addition, that there was a point in time through those dialogues where we actually changed the structure of our agendas. So on the main board, you ended up with a banner very clearly sending a signal to the public, we are having very specific conversations about the community colleges. When I came into this role with my predecessor's departure as the Vice Chancellor for Community Colleges, of course, my responsibility was staffing this committee. So one of the first things I did was look back at this charge and all of the agendas since the inception of the committee. And I'm going to be honest, it was a little disappointing, and I think you all know that because many of you I have spoken with individually, and when you look at the number of action items over the course of 5 years, there weren't very many. However, when you look at the charge, it had a charge that was created in a way that's very different than our traditional standing committees. So if you look at that section of the handbook and you look at ARSA and you look at BFF and you look at the investment committee, you know, there are certain, it's more succinct than what was there. Where what occurred with the community college committee, given the fervor around the conversation at that time, was a charge that focused on 6 critical areas for research and analysis. Well, the unfortunate part was when you look back at all of those agendas, a lot of that research and analysis did not happen at the level that one might have expected. So it begged the question, can we improve the structure of this committee? So with that, we began a number of conversations. I spoke with the community college presidents on several occasions. I spoke, obviously, with the chancellor and the vice chancellor for workforce, trying to figure out a way where we can leverage a committee structure And in many respects, it's an opportunity to get out in front of AB 450, because some of the dialogues that will occur in AB 450, they're not going to be able to address them in the short period of time that they have to deal with a number of complex issues. So we're creating a platform so that the chancellor and her co-chair through AB 450 can say, okay, this is an issue that we may not be able to deal with here, but we have this committee at the board level that can help support this work going forward. What is important, I think, given the political consternation around community colleges that long ago, way back in 2014, when you look at the charge as it is currently codified, and it's all in italics print in the briefing paper, we went through and identified each of those issues and where those conversations are actually occurring, and in some cases at a more robust level. And I won't go into that in any great detail, but there are workforce aspects to the existing charge that will be retained in the proposed charge, but many of the other issues are already addressed either by the full board or by the Academic and Research and Student Affairs Committee, because what we don't want to convey through the action of revising the charge of this committee is that we are in any way pulling back from our focus on community colleges. Actually, quite to the contrary. So with that, I would refer you to page 5 of the proposal, where you can see the boldface italics is the proposed language. And I'm going to just take you through these items quickly. So item number 1 with the proposed workforce committee is to advise the board on workforce training programs offered by the community colleges. And you'll notice in every single item except for number 6, we make sure we say community colleges, because we're trying to enforce the fact that the focus of the committee will not change. So workforce training programs offered by the community colleges in areas including but not limited to hospitality, tourism, culinary arts, healthcare, information technology and coding, and applied technologies, construction, manufacturing, transportation, automotive, air conditioning. These are all the things that we've just talked about, all of these critical areas that it gives it a hyper-focus within this committee. Subsection 2, consider and recommend board policies that support workforce development and training programs of the community colleges. That's actually embedded in more language in the current charge. So we're maintaining that focus. Make recommendations to align degree and workforce credentialing offered by the community colleges, including but not limited to non-credit and accelerated programs. Now, non-credit is mentioned in the current charge, but that's not an area that this committee has dived into. So given the way the prior presentation teed that up, that may be an area that this committee wants to consider in the future, and I would recommend that. Number 4, review and make recommendations regarding the strategic initiatives of the community colleges developed to support workforce strategies adopted by the board. Number 5, review and make recommendations for programs that promote student access, success at community colleges, including but not limited to the SSOG and Promise program. Now, that's actually an area that's traditionally in academic and student affairs, but given the toggling in some respects, and because this committee has focused on that before, we felt that it was appropriate to give it a strong nod here. And finally, I think this is one of the most important acknowledgments of the policy, which is that despite this hyper-focus on community colleges, workforce dialogues and workforce support and workforce training and workforce degrees occurs throughout the system. We have universities that have been around for 147 years, and they have been doing workforce for 147 years. So we mention in subsection 6, the provisions of subsection G do not preclude the committee from including the four-year institutions in workforce and strategic discussions as outlined in this section. So you as chair will have the prerogative, as you have workforce dialogues going forward, to say, okay, for this particular issue or not, we want to make sure that we include the four-year institutions, and of course that includes our state college. And there is information in the briefing paper about how within the four-year institutions, their focus is shifting in many respects. Again, I think this is prudent given the timing of AB 450. We are not in any way pulling back on our focus on community colleges. In many respects, I think this strengthens it, because it gives you a meaty charge that is more focused and delineated and aligned in terms of structure with the other committees. So with that, Madam Chair, I would be happy to answer any questions and beg your approval. I will also indicate that with this transition, should the board approve it, Vice Chancellor of Workforce Caleb Cage will begin to staff this committee, but of course I will be there to support him in any way as the Vice Chancellor for Community Colleges.
Thank you, Vice Chancellor. Regent Moran.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of quick things. First, on the recommendation, Crystal, what a terrific job. I mean, this is really a thorough job. It was outlined perfectly. It was briefed perfectly. It really just laid it out, made it very, very easy for us to understand what it is that we need to do, why, how, and what the ultimate result is going to look like at the end of the day in terms of, you know, the content involved in the particular bylaw change. The second item that I thought that was important, again, in making the case that I would ask that we do be decisive, we show leadership today, and that we move this particular item forward, not just because it's the right thing to do and not just because it's our staff that's recommending that we do this, but it also sets a message and sends a message to the legislature that, you know what, the Board of Regents is thinking ahead. We're on a 20,000-year plan as opposed to what are we doing yesterday and what did we have for breakfast yesterday. So I think this is really, really terrific. Obviously, workforce development is really huge in the community college system. And so I got to tell you, Crystal, I'm glad that you took this, ran with this, and that's really why you do what you do. And do it so well. And thank you for going above and beyond and looking at a methodology that we could put in place to show that we're really thinking about the stuff that we're doing. We're not just sitting here listening to things and moving things down the road. So I'm really excited about this, and I hope the rest of the board will listen to some of the comments I made, also look at the recommendation made by the Chancellor's Cabinet. And this is, again, this is a really... this is a really great start to a new initiative, a new beginning, and what I would kind of contemplate and characterize as a reset. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, if that's a motion, I'll second that.
Oh,
I got a comment.
So I'll take that as a motion and a second. Thank you. And Chair Del Carlo, did you have a comment?
I did. I just want to give credit where credit's due. I had been the community college chair, and then Regent McAdoo took it over. And in her methodical way, she's the one that went into the charge and got it all changed, and everyone needs to know that. So she worked with Crystal on 99% of it. So thank you, Regent McAdoo.
I did want to echo that as well. I know that you worked very hard on focusing in on workforce and community colleges. So I really do appreciate the work that you've done on this, Regent McAdoo. Yes, please.
As always, the best work is done by teamwork. So it took all of us. Thank you.
Thank you. Regent Brooks, did you have something?
I do. Thank you very much. I just have a couple of questions regarding the charge. Essentially, how does this affect the committee as we know it, the way it sits right now today, the Community College Committee?
In terms of membership or
in terms of
direction?
Yeah, not so much direction, because it looks like there's some new direction that the committee will be able to go into. But what I'm wondering is, how does it change our committee? In other words, the members who are part of the Community College Committee as we sit right now, does this kind of revamp what that looks like and changes committee personnel and things that will be done under the heading of Community College Committee?
I think that that's definitely something that the chair can consider. And I think it might be appropriate in new business if you'd like to consider that officially.
Madam Chair, I think I can add some light
Vice
to this.
Vice Chancellor Abba.
So historically in the past, when committees have been changed in this nature, the current constitution remains the same. Okay. However, the chair would have the discretion if they want to change that membership. But given the fact that we're halfway through the year before they reset those committees, it's probably not necessary. And my personal recommendation would be that you don't need to do that. So this committee would continue on the cycle that it's on, which is meeting every December and June. It's just the focus would change and the title of the committee would change. So come the next meeting, which for this group would be in June because you're on the off cycle. And as you look at your agenda, it says Community College Committee with the members. It would be exactly the same except for it'll say Workforce Committee.
Does that help?
Yeah, that clears that up for me. Thank you. I greatly appreciate that. My other questions are, what would be the purpose of changing the name from the Community College Committee to the Workforce Committee? And the reason that I'm asking that is it certainly seems as we move forward and we recognize some of the challenges that the community colleges have, it feels like the envelope or the umbrella for which these conversations are going to take place kind of rests underneath the Community College Committee so that we can hear everything that's going on. And while I certainly recognize workforce development to be one of the challenges or a main issue for community college, and certainly business development and networking to ensure that we're listening to some of the corporations that are here in Nevada and what it is that they need so that hopefully we can prevent them from establishing their own academies, right? And allowing the institutions to be able to develop the curriculum based on what these corporations need. It feels like that would still kind of fall under the Community College Committee, not necessarily a workforce committee. That just, for me, it just seems like it's starting to limit, right, the type of conversations that we would have based on the title of the committee to begin with.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes,
so,
please.
Regent Brooks, that's an excellent question, and that is exactly the thing that I think politically is the challenge here. But, and this is, I'm speaking primarily from my perspective, having watched this committee and watched the way other committees have worked. One thing that I have heard, and I've heard this at meetings in the last several months, which is this whole concept of the community college pulling it out, the system within the system, to some extent, speaking to the student affairs officers in particular several months ago, their concern was, we now feel like we're too segregated. Because the reality of it is that we are a system. So I think that's the first thing, which is focusing on the fact that some of the most productive conversations can happen when we have more of a global perspective of the system. But at the same time, there really has to be a balance there. And I think that what we've seen from the prior work of the committee is that while that focus was on community colleges, the robustness of those conversations and the products that came out of them were lackluster. And so by putting a more stringent focus on workforce, which is the key topic of the state right now, you have an opportunity, you meaning this board, has an opportunity to be a leader in an area, and as Regent Moran so aptly put it, get out in front of this. But more important than that, for me as more of a bureaucratic administrator, go back and look at the charges of the other committees. It's not necessarily productive to pull it out and look at it by sector as opposed to looking at topic areas by topic areas like academic and student affairs, like budget and finance, so that you are addressing the entire system through that. But I tried very hard in drafting this, which is why I pointed out that the word community college is in every single subsection, to still send the message to the legislature, to still send the message to the community, to still send the message to the community colleges that there is a community college focus here. But right now, what we need to focus on more aptly is that matter of workforce, given the challenges that we're facing and giving the political pressure with AB 450. And remember, the impetus behind AB 450 was the same dialogue that occurred in 2013, which was that proposal of potentially stripping the community colleges out of the system. So your point, you are spot on, and I tried my best to find the balance, and I may not have struck it, but I'm
no,
with
I
you.
Appreciate. Listen, I appreciate the work that you do, and I've heard nothing but fantastic things about the work that you do, frankly. And so I'm not trying to negate or take away from the accomplishments that you have made in drafting this. And I understand the process of revision after revision to really try to get this done in the best manner that you feel can be done. And I have complete confidence that that's exactly what you achieved. I guess I have some questions and concerns in what it looks like because of some of the political nuance of 450, right? And that part of should we break up essentially the system as we know it and almost have two systems where we have a community college system and then a university system, I think really is what began the conversation. And the end result was, hey, let's just put some committees together and determine what can be done. let's do a study or a focus group on what this will look like in terms of long-term effect. My understanding of it is that even the community colleges, they want everything under the system because it makes it much easier for students to transfer and do some of the things that they've got to be able to do. And if we're under one umbrella, one system, then we're all engaged in essentially almost like the same type of conversations over and over again in terms of improvement. And while today where we sit, workforce development is a absolute hot topic to be able to make sure that our students are getting educated and then placed into the workforce, which should frankly be the goal for every institution. My concern is that what if, let's say in 2 years, there is such great success that we've been able to do this with the relationships that could be built with corporations that are coming in and those that already exist here, that now we have a new focus and it's something else. And maybe the focus has to do with financial aid or another challenge that could come up. Are we then going to take a look at revamping what the structure of the committee is and what that will look like? Because again, under the umbrella of community college committee, that encompasses all of that. We can talk about all of that. And I'm just offering, I guess, that there shouldn't be kind of like almost this bubble that we have to exist in, that we can talk about whatever we want that has to do with the effectiveness of the colleges themselves.
I'd be happy to respond to that.
Go ahead, and then Chancellor Rose has a response as well.
So this moment, by the way, is reminding me of a Lincoln-Douglas debate that I lost in high school, just so you know. So I'm reliving that moment. And so everything that you're saying is spot on. I think the key that you have to remember is that not only are our institutions and is the system organic in terms of responding, so is this board. And you can get out ahead of things, and that's really the point of it. And the other thing, and by the way, I don't take any of this personally, so please don't think so. I mean, I am not the policymaker. My job is to bring the recommendation to you, and you make the decision. So it's not, you all go in the direction that you want to go in. I have no personal claim in that. But I do feel that when you look back over the system, particularly for the last 20 years, it's almost on a cycle of about every 2 to 3 years, the committees get revamped. In the time that I've been, and I'll use the example of ARSA, it has been renamed and reconfigured with the same academic and student affairs focus, but research in, research out, other pieces in and out, more than a dozen times during the 20 years that I have been here. So it's gonna happen. So what you are, your crystal ball is spot on. This committee will change again, and it should change again, because you have to be organic. And I think the most important thing to remember is that this board can react to that and be fluid. That's the beauty of our system in general, too, which is because of our size, we are able to act nimbly and react to situations. So, but it is a little bit of a double-edged sword. You just got to figure out what side of the sword you're on.
And just one more question. I appreciate the length of time that you're allowing me.
Would it be possible for Chancellor Rose to respond real quick?
Yeah.
And
then?
Thank you, Madam Chair, to you and through you to Regent Brooks. I just wanted to offer one quick addition to what Vice Chancellor Abba has shared, and I support her responses, always very thoughtful, and of course carry the institutional perspective of her many years in the system. But I think the only thing that I would offer to you, Regent Brooks, in addition would be that, of course, this board may request us to bring forward any aspect around community college performance context that you wish. And so we serve at your pleasure. And so if there's something that the committee is not dealing with that feels like a critical emergent issue, of course you have the authority to request that to come forward. So I don't think that you would be stymied in any way if there was something outside the bounds of that committee to request at the full board that we hear other issues.
And Regent Geddes, did you have anything more to add? No, thank you. Did you have
just one last question? As I was looking through the information, the items that were crossed off, right, in terms of what the new language would be if adopted, one of the items was number I. It was essentially review and propose possible BDRs or requests for legislation. And my question was, I didn't really understand why that would be taken off the menu in terms of these types of conversations, because obviously, especially with workforce development, if we're exploring more and more, and we certainly need the support of our legislators to be able to get something done, we'd want to be able to bring that to them. And so can you tell me why that was crossed off?
Yeah, I can. For the record, Crystal Atta, Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs and Community Colleges. The reason that that was taken out is because if you look at the other committees, it's not there, and it really is a more appropriate dialogue for the full board. And if you look historically, those conversations, when you have them, when they have been to some extent had at the committee level, they always bubble up to the full board. So there's a little bit of an efficiency issue there. But, I mean, again, it was a judgment call.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate all your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we have a motion from Regent Moran and a second from Regent Perkins. I'll go ahead and take the vote. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, thank you. Okay, motion carries. Thank you. Item number 7, new business. Does any member have new business for the committee?
From the earlier conversation, if I may, Madam Chair, about the non-credit being eligible for financial aid, if we can like just take a, I guess, an in-depth look at that or a greater look at that to solve that problem.
Thank you, Regent Perkins. I think that that's very appropriate at this time. Any other new business? I'll move on to public comment. Any public comment in ELCO?
No public comment in ELCO.
Thank you. Public comment in Reno?
There is none in Reno.
Thank you. Public comment in Las Vegas? We do have some. Welcome.
Good morning. My name is Dr. Sondra Cosgrove, so it's S-O-N-D-R-A-C-O-S-G-R-O-V-E. I'm a history professor at the College of Southern Nevada, but I'm also the vice chair of the Nevada Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and Regent Del Carlo serves on that committee with me. And today we spend a lot of time talking about workforce development and the ability of our students to get jobs and to have paychecks. But when our committee just completed a report on the impact of remote learning on education equity, we heard from a lot of education experts. So we heard from the superintendents, we heard from teachers, we heard from students. And the things that we heard were so troubling to us, we expedited getting that report out with its recommendations. And what we heard is two things. Students are going to have mental health problems now and into the future, and they're going to need to be addressed immediately. But also, the seniors last year spent a whole year on remote learning, and they have learning deficits. Those students are in my community college class right now, and they are suffering. It's not just the usual remediation issues that we're seeing. It's them disappearing for 2 weeks and then coming back and telling me that their child died, and then trying to have to figure out what to do with them. And then some of them just disappear, and I have to give them an F. And what is that going to do to their financial aid eligibility if we don't have a way through assessment or program review or something to capture what's happening with our students, first of all, to help them? They need help. But to make sure that they're not inadvertently denied financial aid because they had some type of an emergency, or that they don't feel like they're stupid. I mean, they keep hearing over and over again that they've had learning loss and there's something wrong with them. And then they're coming into our class, and if they get a few points off, they freak out. They're like, oh my God, is it because I have learning loss? What's wrong with me? And so we in higher ed are going to have to do more than just deal with their need to get a job. They're going to need a whole lot of other supports to be able to get through, not just this semester or next semester, but for a couple of years, because this stuff is really deep-seated. And as you can tell, I'm very passionate about this. And the other faculty that I talk to are very worried about this, and so we're going to need some help. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. Any other public comment in Las Vegas? Written public comment, Winter? No, thank you. Okay, well, I will adjourn the meeting at 9:27.